seconds. Lucas fires for the win.
He got it! He got it! Oh, my goodness! Hands to Brennan. He's in the backfield! He's in the backfield! Adam Decker with the play of the game!
Not a Lucius for three and the win!
He got it! He got it! He got it!
Touchdown, MSU! As Michigan State is now going to the Final Four!
Welcome to the Only Colors Podcast, back after a two-year hiatus. I am LVS, also known as Ben Walensky. I am here with Chris Vanini and Heck Dorland. What's going on, Des?
Not much. First time I've been doing a podcast since I was at the State News, and those were always a fun time, so I'm looking forward to this one.
Same here as well. It's been a while for me, but yeah, this should be fun.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we're coming off of a... not an overwhelming victory last Friday night against Boise State, but one that certainly I think is it's good that it was a victory at all. I thought that it was going to be a tough game heading into it, and while not everything was perfect, I think that we saw a lot of good things, particularly from the defense, and you can't argue with the results, certainly. What did you guys think about the game on Friday, just in general terms?
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, Boise kept it within the spread there, but I actually feel probably more comfortable about MSU after that game than I would have otherwise, given just the yardage, you know, the problems that they had coming in and kind of the question marks, and a lot of those were answered. Some of them weren't, but overall, a good win against a good team. I think Boise's going to be a pretty good team here still. I know they got BYU in a couple weeks, so if they can get on that one, then they'll be – if they can get that win, they'll be right back probably in the top 25 pretty soon. So
if they get that, they're probably not going to lose again, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so kind of makes me think of the deal with TCU last year when I think they lost their first two. They lost to Baylor and SMU and then came through the rest of the year and were pretty good. So
yeah, I can agree with that. I think it was a good win as well. And I like the... you know, the fight the team showed and coming back from being down early in the game. I love the defense. I thought the running game was great, obviously. And I think TCU, I think that's a good win. They've got a couple of tricky games. I mean, BYU, as you guys mentioned, but also, you know, at Nevada, I think is their last game of the season. I think they've got, like, Southern Miss, who gave Nebraska, like, an okay game last week, and I think those are some places they could trip up. But I think yeah, they'll probably win about 9 games or so, 10 games maybe, and be a real good win at the end of the year.
They had a kicker who made 2 field goals on Saturday, which means that they're probably not going to lose at Nevada this year.
For real.
No, they're not, now he's not shanking it all over the place. But in any event, back to our guys. You know, the thing that I thought when I was leaving the stadium on Friday night after the game was over was that was... It was a feeling I don't know if I've ever experienced with MSU football before. It was the most undramatic victory I can imagine, particularly in a close game. I can't ever remember a game like that where MSU basically did the boa constrictor thing on the opponent in the last 7-8 minutes of the game, just absolutely squeezed the life out of a very good opponent. Got the ball back with 6.5 minutes to go and ran the ball over and over and never let them have the ball again. I can't ever remember a game ending like that for MSU, and it was amazing to watch.
One I remember is Wisconsin back in 2010. They did something similar, but yeah, it was great to see that because they definitely couldn't do it last year. Yeah, for sure.
No, yeah, I remember when I think the last first down the Bell picked up, and we're like, wait, is that it? Oh, it is okay. Yeah, it's over. It was kind of like a... For all the recent finishes, you know, the Hail Marys, the fake field goals, every big game has always seemed to come down to a big play. You know, Iowa on the last play in 2009, Michigan in overtime, and then this one with all the hype for the team coming into the year, and then it was just kind of like, okay, they won.
Yeah,
I imagine there were some gamblers who were just like begging that D'Antonio play card got flipped up with Bielema somewhere so they could cover that spread.
Oh God, that was for the people who had Boise in the game. That was definitely one of those great moments in gambling history, right there at the end when D'Antonio took the knee. I was with you, Chris. I was totally confused by the end of that game because particularly when Boise took the timeout for, as it turned out, for no reason whatsoever. It's like, wait, am I missing something here? Is this game over now? It was so undramatic at the end of the game. I walked out of the stadium feeling like it, you know, there was no real climax to it. But fantastic win. In any event, the most hyped opening game I can remember of my MSU fandom. I mean, people talked about it at the USC game in 1988, and or 1987, but that might have been the case. But obviously, that was before my time as an MSU fan. So it was pretty incredible. I thought it was a tremendous atmosphere at the stadium. Both of you guys were there, right?
I was not.
You were not. Oh, I'm no, sorry.
I was. Traffic getting in was a mess. Obviously, with Labor Day weekend, a lot of people going up north. I didn't get out of here in Detroit until 4, but got up there probably about 6:30. So once kind of got onto 96, things were okay. But yeah, a lot of Boise fans there. Over on One Bronco Nation Under God, the Boise State SB Nation blog. I was talking a little bit with some of the readers over there, and the time that they had, they thought the relationship between the fans was great, even building up to the game. I know that both of these fan bases were like, well, after Friday, we're going to be rooting for you guys because you guys seem pretty cool. And, yeah, I mean, the new scoreboards and everything, there was definitely a different feel in the stadium than I can remember, really.
Absolutely.
I heard some complaints about the like the sound on the scoreboards. Did you guys have any thoughts on that?
It was loud.
I was on the south side, and it was actually kind of hard to hear the PA guy. It also seemed like they were trying to figure out what a good volume for the music was, because sometimes it was too quiet, sometimes it was too loud. I know the "What is your profession?" chant, they did it once, I remember, and it was on the other side, and it was really quiet, and having to adjust to moving the sound to the other side. I think there might have been some first game struggles there where they had to kind of figure out what the good sound was in terms of that.
I will lay it out for the record: if the "What is your profession?" chant is down from Spartan Stadium, I'm not going to shed a tear for it.
I liked it. It gets the people involved for a big play and something like that. But yeah, I only remember I think twice, and the first time I didn't even hear it.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than Jandl and Tees on third down, I suppose.
Absolutely.
But it's, you know, there's only so long we can keep on celebrating that movie. I think it's getting a little old at this point. But I was on the north side of the stadium. My tickets are in section 27, just a kind of the northwest corner of the stadium, and it was very loud there. So I don't know whether they're channeling most of the volume to the north end of the stadium, but I had no problems on that end. I was right kind of underneath the big ribbon board, which was blinding at times. And you mentioned it, how it's a little disconcerting to look up right at a big third down play and see a huge advertisement for chocolate milk.
That one stuck out.
I was kind of anticipating the auto owner's insurance ads, but chocolate milk, that wasn't really one that I thought marked.
Yeah, it was, I don't even remember the brand. That one stuck out. I mean, there was the typical auto owner's insurance and Farm Bureau and Huntington Bank, but then I remember the chocolate milk, and that one really stuck out. But you mentioned it blinding. I was on the other side, and there were a couple times where the ribbon and the screens were white for some sort of ad, and it was blinding on my side too. Because I mean, I'm facing it, and so I mean, my parents were sitting on the other side, like where you were, and they said, depending on what was showing, it would feel like it was really bright, and then it would feel like the lights went out depending on whatever. I'm sitting over there for the Notre Dame game, so I'm going to be experiencing that in 2 weeks.
And I don't know whether it was an issue. Well, so they had a field-level cameraman on kind of the riser on the west side of the stadium there, so it was kind of blocking my view of the stadium a little bit, because I have seats that are fairly down low, so it was blocking my view of the field. And I don't know if it was a function of that or just because you can't look away, but I think I found myself watching about half of the plays on the big screen and not on the actual field.
The old Gary World trick.
Exactly. I didn't even realize that I was doing it until after the play was over, but it's definitely the stadium is so much different than it used to be. I think mostly for good, but except for the helmet shuffle, which is now completely impossible.
Oh, man. That's possible. They had five. If you weren't there, they had five helmets.
Oh my lord!
And at the very end, it's just a cluster. Everything goes in the middle, and you're not gonna, unless they adjust it. You're never gonna win it.
They started boring everything. It was a disaster. There was no way to win it. But you guys want to talk about actual football?
Yeah, let's do that.
So the defense was absolutely fantastic. They scored on a pick six, and there was only one drive where they got points from really advancing the ball against the defense. The rest of it was close to a shutout performance by the defense, and it was everything I could have hoped it would be.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the defensive front, you didn't get any sacks, but they were getting pressure. Joe Southwick did a good job of getting the ball out. Obviously a good game plan, and obviously that was what Peterson game plan for, but linebackers, Boise averaged something around a yard or two a carry. They couldn't establish a run at all, and when you got a rookie quarterback in that environment, there was not much they could do. MSU pretty much executed everything to a T on that front.
Yeah, I'm just so impressed with how this team can, attack teams and get into the backfield. But then, there was a play where, MSU sent two linebackers up the middle, did the double A gaps thing, and Boise, they checked to a bubble screen like, you're supposed to beat that blitz. And then Darquez Denard beats his block and, tackles the receiver, in the backfield for an incompletion. I was just like, man, if I was an offensive coordinator, I would just not know what to do in that situation.
Johnny Adams did one of those right in front of where I was sitting and just threw his receiver to the ground and got him. It was pretty impressive, really.
And I thought that Johnny Adams was really, really good in run support all game long.
Absolutely.
He was in the backfield so often, and I think he had to have at least two or three tackles on running plays at or near the line of scrimmage. I thought that, we heard so much over the offseason about Denitros Allen, and I think rightly so, but for me, Chris Norman and Max Bull in particular had absolutely fantastic games.
Yes. But,
you really, it's difficult to single out any one person. It was, incredible push from the defensive line on the rushing plays, and the linebackers supported very well. 24 rushes for 37, 38 yards against a competent offense, no matter how many starters they have to replace. That's just an absolutely dominating performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Norman has really grown into that linebacking spot where a lot of times he's in coverage. Obviously, being a senior, he's been through it a lot, and that was a problem with Narduzzi's defense back in 2009 when they always had linebackers covering receivers. But now that the defensive backs have become competent and pretty smart, helps put him in a good situation, and whether it comes up for the run or stays back in the pass, his build and his skills has been perfect for that position. And now in his third or fourth year doing it, he's obviously ready to go there.
If I could single out another player, Makaja Reynolds, who,
yes,
man, he came out of nowhere, but he just slid into that starting spot, and first play of the game, he's in the backfield causing a run for the loss. Some other plays in the third quarter, he's consistently beating his man. He's disrupting things. I didn't even I thought that job was Hoover's for sure, and he just came on so hard over these last couple weeks, and just I thought he played a great game.
Yeah, they've loved him on whatever side of the wherever he's been. They've loved him there, and I remember, I think it was, I don't know if it was before or after the bowl game last year, Narduzzi said to him, he said, if you keep playing like this, you're not going back to offense. And then and then I think he did at the beginning of fall camp. I might be mistaken. And
he switched like 8 or 9 times. And something ridiculous.
And I couldn't tell really the line play from my view in the stadium. I did watch the tape again, he definitely stuck out, and mostly because all the focus is on Anthony Rashad White, but he has been, just as solid.
Absolutely. Moving over to the offense a little bit, it's a little bit of concern about Andrew Maxwell. He had a rough first half, obviously. Seemed to settle down a little bit in the second half when things simplified, and really the game plan turn to the passing game strictly as a compliment for Le'Veon Bell doing what Le'Veon Bell does. Do you have any – what did you think about what you saw from Maxwell? Did you are you concerned about it? Were you happy with the adjustments, things of that nature?
I mean, the first drive, they go right down and score. We're like, okay, this is going to be a pretty good season. And but then Boise started changing things up. He makes a couple ill-advised throws. You know, the obviously the first pick wasn't his fault, bouncing right off of, I think it was Tony Lippitt. But the second one, the pick six, I've seen people go back. I've seen two different sides of this. I'm on the side that he shouldn't have thrown that ball. Either take the sack or throw it in the dirt. Caper wasn't quite – I don't think he was quite turned around, and Maxwell just rifled it in there because he was on falling down. But a couple times he threw that while he was going down. One of them was actually completed. But and then the third one was obviously his fault in the bad throw.
I think the one that was completed, are you talking about the one that was tipped by the defensive end and then Le'Veon Bell caught it? Because that very easily could have gone for an interception.
Yeah,
I think that was in the first half as well.
There were a couple. There were a couple he threw to, I think, either a tight end or someone in triple coverage, and it bounces up in the air and lands on the ground. That first half, the feeling in my section was every time the offense had the ball, you were worried. You just wanted to get a lead. You just wanted to get a lead, and then you trusted the defense to just hold on as long as he didn't make any terrible mistakes.
Yeah, because it seemed like Boise was much more likely to score points on defense than they were on offense.
And they did. They scored
more
points. Yeah, but, exactly. The second half was exactly what you want out of him. They simplified. They had him throw short passes to Sims and out passes on the receivers, nothing too big, and just rely on Le'Veon Bell picking up 5 yards carry. And if he can just be second half Maxwell, doesn't have to be flashy, but don't make any big mistakes, then the team has a chance to go really far.
Yeah, I think that's right. If there's any point where I was really down on Maxwell, I think it was probably that third interception. I mean, he had Mumphrey like pretty wide open in an area of the field near the goal line, and he just threw it way behind him to like some defender who just wasn't even in the picture, and I mean, the defender made a pretty good play on the ball, to his credit. But like, if there's any like warning bells about Maxwell, it's that like that was not a great throw. But I think, I mean, like you guys mentioned, I was pretty impressed with how he rebounded. I thought, you know, as the game wore on, I think he settled down, and as we get more games into this sample size, I think we'll have a better idea of who he is as a quarterback.
He had a little bit of a Brett Favre in him. Every pass was coming 100 miles an hour. And yeah. I think even on that last pick, if he just puts a little touch on it and puts it out in front of the guy, as opposed to just trying to rifle it into a window that was pretty wide open, he'll pick up on that. Obviously, I think he had some first game jitters. But
yeah, that seems like something that's highly correctable.
Yeah.
I think the guy who had as much to do with Maxwell's turnaround as anybody else was Deion Sims. Mm-hmm. And I was I was kind of a Deion Sims skeptic heading into the season. I wasn't, you know, we had seen things from time to time from him, but he hadn't really broken into the lineup with all that much consistency in the first 2 years. And I was skeptical what he could bring to the team, what we could expect from him really this year. And he was terrific. He turned into Maxwell's security blanket, particularly in the second half, and came up with a huge third down conversion in the fourth quarter. There was a third and nine or something like that, and got it right by the sideline. Made a very nice catch on a play that Bell had a terrific blitz pickup. I was really impressed with Deion Sims, and obviously it's got to be a priority to incorporate the wide receivers back into the passing game. But if you can get that kind of production from Sims, that's going to be a really tremendous new dimension to the offense.
Yeah, I wrote about that for the free press for the season, that he's the most he was going to be the most important guy, if only for the fact that he had the experience and Maxwell could be comfortable throwing to him. I mean, last year, He missed a lot of the time with the broken wrist or broken hand. He had the club on his hands. So there's not much he can do there. But at the beginning of the year, they were throwing fade routes to him at the goal line. You don't see many tight ends do that. And I mean, the ability's always been there. And also, obviously, having Linthicum and Charlie Gant and Garrett Celek on the depth chart, it was hard to get consistent playing time, especially because those guys are better at blocking, and that's what MSU loves to do with the tight ends. And actually, shout out to Garrett Celek for making the 49ers as an undrafted free agent, so it's pretty impressive. So obviously MSU's had a good group of tight ends, and now he's the only guy there with any experience, and Maxwell was going to look to him on the short throws when they needed something, and that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. I think he fills kind of a really key role in this offense. I think he kind of replaces B.J. Cunningham in that role where, you know, MSU would just throw the slant to him for like 7 yards all day last year. And that was sort of what I saw Deion Sims doing in this game. And we kind of use our wideouts a little deeper downfield. I mean, I think Fowler and Lippitt were both over like 18 yards a catch. So it seems like they're almost incorporating the wide receivers into more of that vertical passing game that Rauscher talked about when he took over as offensive coordinator. And they're going to maybe use Bell and Sims as kind of this intermediate passing game.
So speaking of Le'Veon Bell, he's awesome. I don't really know what else there is to say about it.
You know, that's an acceptable answer. Yep.
he had a Javon Ringer versus FAU kind of game, both in the production standpoint and in the potentially overworked standpoint. I think that Le'Veon Bell, because of his size, is in a position to absorb that a whole lot better than Ringer did over the course of the year. But I'm hoping that this week against Central, we can get enough of a lead to give him a rest a little bit. And no matter how much that might hurt his embryonic Heisman campaign, which I don't think anything will come of that anyway. But in any event, he was terrific. I don't know what else there's to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, D'Antonio likes to give it to the hot back. Well, he averaged something like more than three and a half yards per carry on first down alone. I mean, every single play they're getting the second and medium, second and short, and they couldn't, from the coach's perspective, probably they couldn't afford to take him out, because if they put Larry Caper in and you know, he doesn't get anything, then you put the pressure on. Every single time they gave him the ball, he picked up something, and it was just too valuable to take out. And part of the reason, yeah, he got 44 carries, 50 touches, but MSU ran 90 plays.
Yeah.
They're not going to run I mean, maybe against Central if it's a blowout. You run 90 plays in a game if you're doing a hurry-up, or if you're blowing out a team and you're putting all the backups and run the ball a million times with them. I mean, 90, I think it was something to like 90 to 55 total plays.
But yeah, MSU's time of possession was 38 minutes and change, something like that.
Yeah, compared to...
we basically doubled them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if only for the fact that they're not going to run so many plays, he's not going to get 40 carries a game.
Yes.
Because, I mean, Maxwell had, I think, 38 passes. That's probably more pass. They passed it more than they would like, and they ran it more than they would like, but they just ran so many plays, really.
Yeah, that's what will happen with 4 turnovers.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is, you talked about how Bell was so consistent in picking up yards on first down. It's not as if Boise didn't know what was coming their way. I mean, particularly in the middle of the game when Maxwell was really struggling and MSU didn't have a viable passing game to turn to, you knew that Bell was coming straight ahead, basically. I mean, it was obviously different plays, but you knew who was going to get the ball, and Bell picked it up the yardage every single time. It was just a remarkable performance.
Go ahead.
My theory on Bell is that our nuclear physics lab, to get their funding from the government, actually built like a smaller cyclotron in his chest, kind of like Iron Man. And, you know, when he gets his legs moving enough, it just sort of creates all this dark matter that just kind of hurls tacklers off his body. It's the only explanation I really have for how he can do that.
There was Brian Fisher of CBS Sports had a line about T.J. Yeldon during the Michigan-Alabama game, said he does such a great job of a little move, and so no one can ever square up on him and get a good shot. And I thought that's a fitting description of Le'Veon, whether it's just a little hesitation, a little move of the shoulder. No one ever gets a square shot on him, and that's why he's able to bounce off so many tackles and, you know, take three guys with him down, because you think you got him, and then you don't quite get him, you don't quite grab him the way you thought you were going to, and he's able to just blow past you. He's always had that vision, even since he was right when he came in as a freshman. You could tell he had the vision. He knew how to follow the blocks. He knew how to line himself up. against a defender. And now that he's the feature back, we're going to be seeing that every run pretty much.
And it's incredible that nobody can square up on him because it's not like he's a small target. He's a 245-pound guy who...
big square.
Yeah, nobody can... Exactly. Nobody can really square him up, exactly like you said. And to what you said, Chris, he's one of the most patient running backs I've seen at the college level. He does not, sprint right at the first, emergence of a hole. He can see he waits. He doesn't make rash decisions once he's got the ball. He follows his blocks, even if they take a moment to open up. He's just the patience that he shows amazes me on every single play.
I know. I remember I was watching the Virginia Tech Georgia Tech game, and I think it was a Virginia Tech guy. He was running, and if he had waited one moment for I think it was the pulling guard or the tight end or something, if he waits a moment, gets a block, and he's got a first down. Instead, he just runs straight into the defender and ends up getting tackled short when the blocker was coming right there. And I'm curious. I've never seen a 40 time on Bell. I know he's not the fastest guy, but I think it's also it's part of him knowing he can't burst through the hole in speed past guys, but it's also knowing that the best thing for him to do is wait for the block instead of just trying to run into a defender every time
and then hurdle them.
Yes. Did you see that picture? He's got to be 3 feet over the guy.
Way up in the air.
And it's not like something he's never done before. He hurled a guy in the Outback Bowl. He did against Iowa. And the spin move, every single play, it's a spin move. You know it's coming, and they just cannot stop
it. And he always gets 4 yards out of it.
Yep, and he spins, and he falls forward 3 yards, too. Mm-hmm. And the guys will jump on his back, and they'll push him forward another 5 yards. He doesn't have the top-end speed, but he's got the combination of the size, the strength, and the moves. He's not a power back in the sense of a TJ Duckett, Ron Dayne type guy. Obviously, he can run over you, but he can get past you without having to speed by you.
Yeah, he's not J.U. Tolkirk.
No,
he's not a bowling ball. He's got moves.
I mean, really, would you say he's the halfway point between Javon Ringer and J.U. Tolkirk? I know Javon had strength, but he never really ran over defenders because of his size.
That's kind of fair. Just in one package, the guy's so much better than I ever thought he would be. He had such a terrific game his freshman year against Notre Dame, and then he quieted down a little bit in the second half of the year. And I really thought that he was going to be a little bit of a flash in the pan, but my goodness, I was wrong about that.
Yeah,
very happy to be wrong.
When a 2-star recruit comes in and rolls early, and Antonio says this guy's going to play, then
yeah.
He knew what was coming.
You guys mentioned Ringer, and if I could segue kind of back onto him in this comparison that all the Spartan fans are making with concerns about Bell's workload. I know we're all a little gun-shy once our running backs start hitting, that Ringer zone of 40-plus carries. But I thought it was interesting looking over the data on this question. Out of the top five running backs and carries each year, so out of like those 25 guys in the last 5 years, there were only two who were under like 4.5 yards a carry. One of them was Ringer, which might explain why we're all a little biased and freaked out towards it. And the other one was Ricky Dobbs of Navy, who of course is an option quarterback. So that's always going to be a little screwy with the Paul Johnson, flex bone. So maybe even if he ends up running 30 carries a game, there's still a pretty good odd that he's going to hit that 4.5, which I think everyone would probably be happy with, right?
Yes. And Bell has a much better offensive line in front of him than Ringer did. Which helps quite a bit. Though I thought the offensive line disappointed a little bit in pass blocking on Friday night, Boise was able to get some pressure on Maxwell, as we talked about before, but their run blocking, as far as I'm concerned, was relatively faultless.
Yeah, pass blocking has usually been the strength. I mean, in the D'Antonio era, that they're usually toward the bottom of the conference in sacks allowed. Now, part of that reason is because you got a smart quarterback and whatnot, but and they want to run the ball compared to some of the spread teams. But Boise, from my view, it looked like Boise threw a lot of blitzes in there that they were not able to pick up very well.
Yeah, I think that might just be a that might be a function of that 4-2-5 that Boise runs and those small, quick defensive ends. I mean, France got beaten a couple times. McDonald got beat a couple times. Bell missed a block in the backfield. Just some things like that happened. So I think it was sort of a situation of Boise trading in effectiveness on the run game for a better attack at our passing game, which obviously in the end didn't end up working out for him, but at least gave him a shot.
Yeah. All right. So all in all, maybe not the resounding victory that we had hoped for, but
a satisfying win though, right?
Very satisfying win over a team that really hasn't lost games like this. And it doesn't, everyone who's trying to minimize the win says, they've got so many returning starters. These coaches know how to coach this team. These guys, they have such a track record of playing incredibly well in these first games of the season against big name opponents, and MSU is one of the first teams to take them down, and that feels damn good, I have to say.
Definitely.
So the rest of the – if we can talk about the conference at large for a minute or two, the rest of the conference didn't look so good.
No.
with a couple of exceptions, but MSU's was by far the most I don't even want to say impressive, but it was by far the best conference win this past weekend. Anything stick out to you guys in terms of conference play, teams that you thought looked better than you figured, teams that looked terrible? You're allowed to talk about Michigan here if you feel like it.
I'll just tweet about it. But I mean Nebraska obviously against a pretty good defense in Southern Miss and losing Rex Burkhead for a bit. I don't think Taylor Martinez is going to put up those numbers, but from that perspective, it's got to be at least encouraging that he was able to shoulder a lot of that. No pun intended, the way he throws the ball, but. I thought that was a pretty good win over a pretty good Southern Miss team. I think a lot of people are overlooking them for the in the Legends division. But, I don't know. I still think it'll come down to Michigan State. But as far as debuts go, if you're Nebraska, I mean, you probably couldn't ask for much more as long as Burkhead's not out for an extended period of time.
Yeah, I'm not sure how – I guess the book on Southern Miss is open a little bit with Larry Fedora not there any longer, but Taylor Martinez was really impressive. I think I'm guilty of that a little bit, kind of having State of Michigan tunnel vision in the Legends division. But Nebraska could be there, and they get Michigan at home this year, I think, right?
Yep.
They play in East Lansing, I know that, but I think they have Michigan.
It's going to be a 3-week span where MSU plays Michigan, then the next week MSU plays Wisconsin, Michigan plays Nebraska, and the next week MSU plays Nebraska. So that 3-week stretch is going to pretty much determine everything.
Yeah, especially because Iowa looked pretty terrible.
Yeah.
So bad.
I mean, Northern Illinois is a pretty good team, but it was, Vandenberg was supposed to be the strength, and they had some major trouble.
Yes. What, you guys aren't excited to see the horizontal offense come to the Big Ten?
Right, Davis.
I mean, I guess from a defensive standpoint, almost all the yards they gave up were on that one long quarterback draw. But, I don't know. They got a favorable schedule, so they'll be in it. But, they don't have the talent to stick around.
Disregarding the fact that they're not eligible for the championship game, do you guys think that Ohio State's the best team in the leaders division?
I didn't see much of the Wisconsin game. But Danny O'Brien's numbers look pretty good, and Monty Ball and that offensive line are going to be just fine. I watched the first half of Ohio State live, and Don Treadwell there, if not for a couple bad throws, the Redhawks could have been leading after at least the first quarter. They got down there pretty easily a couple times, but they just didn't have enough to stick in it. But I guess I'll wait. I think who they play, Cal this weekend, I think. Yeah. I guess we'll. A little bit. I mean, it's a better opponent, although Cal just lost to Nevada, so who knows there. I mean, we don't really ever know. Obviously, we know it's a good offensive fit, and Braxton Miller put up some nice numbers, but I guess I'll withhold my judgment on them for now, at least.
I think I'd also probably stick with Wisconsin as the favorite in that division right now as well. Although I'll give Ohio State quite a bit of credit. They looked, after that shaky first quarter, they looked much better than I thought they would, much sooner than I thought they'd look that good. So, credit to them. They looked definitely like a contender if they were eligible, which they're not.
How much of a loss do you think Blake Countess is for Michigan?
I think he's the only cornerback that you could count on.
I don't think you have to look any further than the reactions of their fan base, right?
Panic.
Yeah,
I mean, but that also speaks to something else I wrote about. They have a bunch of starters on their special teams, while MSU is full of redshirt freshmen and guys that didn't play last year, but guys that they still trust. And I think, along with the blowout loss to Alabama, that's another way to look at where the program is at right now, where they're still relying on guys to do so much at so many different things. They don't have the depth built up, but they'll obviously get there. But losing him. While they're already having to replace a lot of that defensive line, now their passing game, I mean, they brought almost everybody back, but I know Kovacs is pretty good, but he's probably the guy that they could least afford to lose, I think, on the outside.
Do either of you think Purdue has a chance against Notre Dame this week?
No.
I didn't really see much of Purdue. I did watch most of Notre Dame. Everett Golston looked pretty good, but I mean, it's at Notre Dame. Purdue
they're having their quarterback shuffle again, despite the fact that Robert Marr was pretty good this past weekend.
But and then they said, nope, Caleb Turbush is still the top guy. So I don't know. Maybe that's a good sign. Robert can play that good and still not get the starting job.
I don't trust them either. And Notre Dame just stomped them last year, and I can't get that out of my head either. So yeah, I don't know if I can trust them this week. I'll be rooting for them though for sure.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting because there's that theory out there that MSU has had reasonable success against Notre Dame over the years because Michigan has softened Notre Dame up the week before, and we don't get the benefit of that anymore if it actually is a benefit. So Purdue, I hope you can wear those guys down. I don't think it's gonna happen.
It's the first time since I think 97, 98, late 90s, first time that MSU plays Notre Dame before Michigan does, which will be interesting, I think. This weekend, I'm actually going up to Mackinac and with my wife's family, and some friends of theirs come up, and they always watch the Notre Dame-Michigan game that weekend because some of them are Notre Dame fans, some of them are Michigan fans, but obviously can't do that this week because now they're, I think, the fourth game instead of the second game. So a little bit of change of pace, nothing wrong with that.
All right, so looking ahead to MSU's game this week at Central Michigan, I suppose that's still a little point of contention at the fan base. I don't have any problem playing these games on the road.
Me neither.
I think it's kind of fun, honestly.
Besides, if you're paying $500,000 to $600,000 to bring a crappy team in anyway, might as well have some fun with it. Let somebody else enjoy it. Get some more enjoyment out of it.
And It's easy to say that I have no problem with it because I will poison the well straight ahead, and I think MSU is gonna do just fine in this game. And I think that's partially because I like the team that MSU has on the field, but I don't think that Central Michigan is a particularly good football team. They had to come back three separate times to beat. Southwest Missouri State, I think it was.
Yeah, Southwest or Southeast.
One yeah. This past weekend, I didn't watch any of that game, but the accounts that I've read are that Central did not look very good. And in any event, Daniel Fever is not running out of that tunnel. So it'll be interesting because it's – I mean, I think people say with some justification this is the biggest home game in the history of that school.
Oh, yeah. And that's really the best part about it. If you – obviously the 0-9 lost. I mean, honestly, that was probably – that CMU team was probably a better team than MSU was that year. That was not a good MSU team, and that was a really good Central team that I think finished the year in the top 25. And, I mean, Dan LeFever was a program-changing player and all that. But it's going to be a great time. We got a Q&A going up later this week with the guys over at Hustle Belt and got a lot of tips on Mount Pleasant and places to go to get certain things, what you want to do. So I think it's gonna be a lot of fun, I think, for a lot of state fans. You know, if you're a student, you have friends up there. A lot of people maybe are alumni there. It's going to be a great time for the city of Mount Pleasant, and it's going to celebrate the state, which is what it was supposed to do, and hopefully everybody has a good time.
Yep, I can echo those thoughts and just, confirm that I as well don't think we're going to have any trouble with this particular CMU team. I did watch a little of their game. I believe it was running before ours. I caught like the last little bit of it, and they were just not looking too good against an opponent who was also not looking too good. and it's just one of these things where there's so kind of like a mirror of our team, just, you know, scheme wise, mm-hmm. that like when you get a situation like that where one team is just better at every position and the other team doesn't have a decided schematic advantage to fall back on.
That's Charlie Weiss.
It's just not good for that lesser team.
So what are you guys looking for this weekend? I would like to see a real emphasis on the passing game this weekend. I think that Andrew Maxwell is in store for a big rebound game, and the wide receivers as well, hopefully. I'd like to see some emphasis on that, not just to take the workload off of Bell a little bit, because I think that he's probably going to be fine either way, but just to wash kind of a somewhat bitter taste out of their mouth after the performance this last weekend. I think that would be nice to see. Is there anything in particular you guys are looking for?
I can drink to that. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, you get Le'Veon Bell, maybe 10, 15 carries, get him out by the second half. Have him chill out. Maybe keep Maxwell in there maybe a little longer than you normally would. Have him focusing on, and along with those starting receivers, defense will do its thing. Try to get all those young guys in there. Shalique Calhoun, Joel Heath, Taiwan Jones. Get those guys. I wouldn't be surprised if you see them play a bit in the first half. If all looks well, try to get them some important minutes. For the future.
Zerlon Tipton is a great name for a running back. That's all I got.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Have fun. That goes out to all the fans and everybody else. Have a good time.
All right. So that will do it for our latest podcast. Chris, I know you're writing for a bunch of different places now. Would you like to tell the fine folks out there where they can find you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot. Most of my writing work in terms of a job is coming from coachingsearch.com. Guy named Pete Russell runs it. Really good site if you want to follow the coaching aspect of things. He's a former coach, a lot of connections, good point of view. So I've been working with him for the last month, and think that's where things are going in terms of my writing career. But I'm still here, still be here covering MSU. You know, it's what I love to do. So go check that site out if you ever want. Go bookmark it. It's a good site. I write a lot there, you know.
Yeah. And you can always find me on Twitter at LVS at TOC. And gentlemen, you're on Twitter as well.
Heck at TOC.
Yep, and Chris Vanini. Not going to bother spelling it. You've probably seen my name somewhere. You can figure it out.
All right, guys. Well, that'll do it for today. And thanks for listening, and go green.
Yep, thanks, guys.
Have a good night.